In state capitals around the country, lawmakers are taking aim at the rights of transgender Americans.
A record number of bills relating to health care, access to bathrooms.
The Kentucky General Assembly passing a sweeping anti-trans bill.
Ohio lawmakers just passed a bill banning trans youth from accessing gender-affirming care.
24 states have banned or restricted gender-affirming care for kids. 300 bills have been introduced in just the last 15 months to restrict trans folks' ability to get health care. Against this backdrop, researchers released early findings in February from the largest survey ever of transgender Americans.
Trans people want to be heard. They want people to be paying attention to what they have to say about their own lives.
Today, lessons from the U.S. Transgender Survey and why hard numbers matter so much in this moment. From the studio at the Leonard Davis Institute at the University of Pennsylvania, I'm Dan Gorenstein. This is Trainables. Sandy James has spent the last decade using research and data to help the public understand transgender people.
Very often, advocates would go out and they would try to talk to policymakers or other individuals, and they would say, well, this is what's going on in the trans population. And the reply would be, well, yeah, but who's that really affecting? Or, oh, can you quantify that for us?
Sandy helped lead the 2015 U.S. Transgender Survey. The survey included more than 300 questions to put cold, hard numbers behind stories of discrimination.
We were hearing from trans people in all walks of life that there were barriers to certain basic needs, whether it was housing, healthcare, employment. Sometimes people would go into a doctor's office and be told, well, we don't treat your kind. And so it was those stories, that anecdotal evidence that was really important for us to try to quantify.
Right, these outrageous stories, but were they sort of one in a thousand or were they one in 10?
Exactly. And it was really important for us to be able to say, oh, it does look like it is indeed one in 10, or it does look like it is a third of people who are experiencing this.
Because once you have that, what does that allow you as advocates to be able to do?
Well, it gives us a starting point. It's evidence that there is something inhibiting trans people from being able to access things like housing and healthcare. And then we have to start asking why. Are there policies that are contributing to those percentages?
So the 2015 survey included more than 27,000 responses and highlighted high rates of psychological distress, suicide attempts, and healthcare discrimination. Fast forward to 2022.
2022 could be the most anti-trans legislative year in history.
And we've seen transgender rights become a part of the so-called culture wars.
It is the latest fight over transgender rights. And once again, the epicenter is Texas.
That was the year Texas Governor Greg Abbott told his state child welfare office to investigate gender-affirming care as child abuse.
Governor Abbott calls on teachers, doctors, and nurses to report if they think these treatments are happening.
So, Sandy, how did that climate influence how you put together this 2022 survey?
So first and foremost, we wanted to see how things might have changed over time. But we also wanted to know how transgender people are being affected by these conversations about them, often happening in ways that people may feel powerless to really combat. And so we wanted to ask trans people directly, how is this affecting you? How has that impacted your day-to-day? And so we wanted to be able to find out what people were experiencing.
You want to give trans people a voice.
Absolutely. What I have noticed is that there's a dearth of conversation that actually includes the voices of trans people. You know, I'm not talking about, you know, in a legislative hearing where people get a minute or two, but actually asking transgender people, you know, as people who are most directly affected by the conversations that are being had, what is it like when you can access healthcare, and what is it like when you're being denied access to healthcare? How might that impact you if your access is revoked?
You said when you published the 2015 survey, part of the goal was to put some numbers, put some data
around the stories. And I'm curious, what were the anecdotes and stories that you were hearing in the run-up to the 2022 survey?
Well, on top of the stories that were similar to those in 2015, we were also hearing more anxiety. We were hearing that people were more fearful. But I think the other thing we wanted to be able to show is that trans people are still getting up, going to work, going out there, doing everything possible, just like everybody else. And so I think that's a big part of the story too. You know, it's how increased anxiety and concern might be impacting trans people, but it's also about how people are getting up and getting on with it.
When we come back, we'll dig into some big numbers from the largest survey ever of transgender Americans.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome back. We're talking with Sandy James, the lead researcher of the 2022 U.S. Transgender Survey, which surveyed more than 92,000 trans Americans and released preliminary findings earlier this year. Sandy, I'd like to dive into the findings now. What's the one number that stands out to you most in this survey?
Yeah, I think the thing that stands out the most are the findings around satisfaction. 98% said that they were more satisfied with their lives after being able to access hormone therapy. And 97% said they were more satisfied with their lives after receiving gender-affirming surgery. You know, any time you do survey research, it's pretty astounding when you have that sort of consensus around any kind of question. And again, it's important to note here, we surveyed over 92,000 transgender people. And of those people who had access to these types of care, it's unequivocal. Overwhelmingly, people said that they were more satisfied with their lives after being able to access these things.
Sandy, I know that along with the survey, you gave people the opportunity to share their own stories. Is there one or even a quote that you can share to help us understand why getting gender-affirming care matters so much to people?
Absolutely. There was one individual, a woman named Rowan, and she said, "I was once still pinned under the sex I was assigned at birth, burned out and depressed and frustrated. But now I am free, accepted, loved, and as happy as ever, as the woman that I am and always was." When you conduct a survey, you're asking people to answer questions that we've crafted very carefully to be able to capture certain data points. But there is something really important about letting people just tell us about their experiences in their own words. And I think that sort of quote really illustrates a finding such as satisfaction with gender transition. You have someone who is saying that they weren't able to really move forward with life. And without putting words in her mouth, I would say that it looks like she's on the path to thriving. Of course, we want the data points. But when you hear it in Rowan's own words, you get a real sense of how impactful it is to have access to this kind of care.
So three numbers caught my eye, Sandy. One, 44% of people said they experienced serious psychological distress in just the last month. 2, 50% of people who sought out medical care in the last year reported a bad experience. And 3, 25% of people said they avoided needed medical care out of fear of mistreatment. All those numbers are higher today than they were back in 2015. What does that tell you?
Well, we've not completed all of our analyses and didn't draw direct comparisons to the 2015 report. But as you've observed, those numbers do appear to be higher. And I think the takeaway from that is that while we might have hoped that we would see drastic shifts in those numbers, we haven't seen that. So, yeah, I would say there's still a lot of work to be done.
Were you surprised?
Sadly, no. And I think that is because of what we've seen in the social and political environment. I think that trans people have been incredibly resilient. I think that there have been improvements here and there. People have been able to access maybe healthcare that they weren't able to before, but I had a sense that it would be impacting people in similar ways, unfortunately.
As we've mentioned, a lot of the anti-trans legislation we've seen enacted has been about restricting trans kids from getting gender-affirming care. Almost half of states have now passed these laws. The 2022 survey, Sandy, included 16 and 17-year-olds for the first time. What did young people have to say?
Well, one of the things that was really encouraging to see was the levels of family support. We saw that approximately half of young people, 16 to 17-year-olds, said their immediate and their extended families were supportive of them as trans people. And that doesn't necessarily align with some of the narratives that you're hearing that are supporting the policies we're seeing. So I think it's important to note that there is family support. And that's really important because we know from what we've seen in the 2015 U.S. Trans Survey and in other research that family support was correlated with lower levels of homelessness. We found that it was correlated with lower levels of serious psychological distress and even suicidality. So the importance of family support just cannot be overstated.
I'd like to circle back to this data point. Half of people who sought medical care in the last 12 months reported a negative healthcare experience, being harassed or being refused care. Trade-Offs is a health policy podcast. You are not a healthcare expert. But I'm curious, what would you like hospital administrators, doctors, nurses to take away from that one data point?
I know this might sound a bit cliche, but I want them to take away that transgender people are people. It's hard to seek healthcare for everyone. And it's made that much harder when you're faced with an environment in which people mistreat you simply because of who you are or how you present.
What does that look like, Sandy? Can you share an example from your own life when you went to get healthcare and you were treated as a whole person?
I really am fortunate because the providers from whom I receive care have committed themselves to creating an environment in which transgender people are respected. And so I'm able to go into a place where I can seek healthcare, and no matter who I'm interacted with, I'm treated with dignity and respect at any stage of the interaction.
And what does respectful care look like?
It's anything as simple as using the correct name. You could, you know, have buttons at the reception area to make sure that you are gendering people correctly. There's all sorts of things that you might be able to do with your electronic record system. But respectfulness really comes down to treating someone as they wish to be treated, which really is how you would wish to be treated too. You know, everyone makes mistakes and nobody's perfect. if you make a mistake, it's important to acknowledge it and processing that and saying, well, how can we make sure that no one else comes through our doors again and has an experience like that? How can we make sure people feel seen, heard, and respected for who they are?
Sandy, you know, we hear a lot about the lack of healthcare data on transgender Americans. You got 92,000 people to spend an hour taking a survey. What advice, what guidance do you have for other health services researchers and policymakers about how to get better at including transgender people in their research?
Well, first and foremost, include questions that allow transgender people to be counted. In some of the large-scale surveys that we all rely on, transgender people are not even included in there in a way that makes them identifiable. Second of all, get to know trans communities. Not just right before you need to collect the data, but spend some time cultivating relationships and then let them know that their voices are powerful and that we really do want to hear from them.
Given the amount of fear that's out there, how hard is it right now, if you're a trans person, to trust someone that you don't know?
I think it's harder than it used to be, for sure. You know, the question is, who are you? You're about to embark on asking me a lot of questions that are in many ways intimate, personal, private, but I think that researchers can work to build that trust. And there are lots of researchers out there who have done a phenomenal job of that. And I think more and more, you know, we just want to be cognizant of people want to know where their data are going to end up. So it's important to be thoughtful of that.
I asked you this question before about the 2015 survey. Do you feel like you captured most of what you wanted to capture? I guess what I'm really asking you is, are there more questions that need to be asked? And do you have a sense of what those are?
I think there's always an opportunity to ask why, follow up on certain findings and find out more about what is really driving a certain outcome. For example, the satisfaction findings, we want to understand why people were more satisfied and why people were less satisfied. We also want to know more about what I'd call trans joy. We want to learn more about what does keep people going, what drives them. We often can't capture things like that in these sorts of surveys. And we want to know more about those aspects of trans lives.
There's a lot of heavy data in this report. What's the one finding that gives you the most hope?
Well, Dan, it's not actually a finding. It is the response that we got to the survey. I'm just astounded that we'd have more than 92,000 people who thought it was well worth their time to complete the survey and contribute to the collective voice of being able to speak about their experiences. That's massive. I like to actually visualize 92,000 people gathered in an area all being able to speak about their own experiences. And that's what we have here. It's powerful. It means that in this moment, trans people want to be heard. They want their voices to count. They want people to be paying attention to what they have to say about their own lives. And that gives me a lot of hope for what it means as this collective voice continues to grow and speak.
Sandy, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us on Trade-Offs.
Thank you, Dan. It was a pleasure.
I'm Dan Gorenstein. This is Trade-Offs. Independent physicians are disappearing. In the early 2000s, they made up more than half of doctors, and now just barely a third. This shift has limited doctors' freedom to dive in deep with their patients.
I most enjoy taking care of complex, ill people who really need diagnostic skills, people skills, etc. from their doctor.
Why practices are getting scooped up and how it could be impacting patient care. Next time on Trade-Offs.
If you enjoyed today's episode of Trade-Offs, don't keep it to yourself. Tell someone else about it. Friend, colleague, family member. Better still, leave a rating or a review wherever you subscribe to us. The NPR app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever. The Trade-Offs team is producers Ryan Levy and Alex Olgan, editors Kate Cahan and Deborah Franklin, executive director Jessica Silverman, marketing director Catherine Dougal, audience engagement lead Shannon Crane, with help from Kate Seepy, Kelly Osmondson, and Cedric Wilson, sound designer Andrew Perella, executive editor Dan Gorenstein, and senior producer Leslie Walker. The Trade-Offs theme song was composed by Ty Sitterman, with additional music this episode from Blue Dot Sessions and Epidemic Sound. Thanks also to all our listeners who helped to support our work, including Linda Blumberg, Ativ Marotra, and Dean and Melissa Walker. Our media partner is Side Effects Public Media, based at WFYI. Trade-Offs is supported by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, Arnold Ventures, the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation, the Sozose Foundation, Just Trust, West Health, the California Healthcare Foundation, the Leonard Davis Institute at the University of Pennsylvania, and the National Institute for Healthcare Management Foundation. Our financial supporters are not involved in any decisions about our journalism, and the views expressed in this episode are those of the individuals and not those of Trade-Off staff, advisors, or funders.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.